Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Tuesday, October 1st, 2024. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the two words that say start here in the upper left-hand corner, it'll take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of the book contains a narrative description and explanation of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for 20 years now to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again absolutely free. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows like this one where people have been stepped through the worksheet process. And if you choose to listen to those even repeatedly, they can serve as a powerful tutorial for you to help you get maximum benefit from these tools in the shortest amount of time possible. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And if you do that before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet. It contains an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and it contains a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We hope people do all of that soon and often, primarily because it tends to improve the quality of people's lives the more they actively apply these tools in their lives, and secondarily because it tends to prompt comments, questions, answers, and testimonials if you have any of those to share with us. We'd appreciate you doing so by giving us a call at 563-999-3581. Once you do that, if you press 1 on your phone, it'll put the little icon of a hand by your phone number. I'll be able to turn on the microphone, announce you by your area code, and we can have a conversation. In lieu of that, if you'd rather not call or don't have access to call live, you can send us an email. You can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org, and or you can email Jeannie at jeannie@whyagain.org. That's whyagain.org. And if we get the comment or question from you, we'll address it on the Internet show, and then as time allows, send you a notification about what day and time that occurred so you can listen back to the archives for your feedback or input. And we are greatly appreciative anytime anybody chooses to do that, because it makes it far easier for us to live into our intention with this work. The intention we have with this work is to be of service, And that's just infinitely easier to do when we know how these things are landing for you. So let us know what's on your mind, how is this landing for you, as we're moving back and forth between the book by Alan Cohen titled Of Course in Miracles that was published this year, and the book Butterflies Are Free to Fly, and the book The Way of Mastery, and looking for similarities and connections that can assist all of us in stepping into our realization that we are the ones creating our experience of life. And if we are unhappy with what we're experiencing, there are certain things we can do within our own mind-body energy system to make changes in an effort to get closer to what we would consider contentment, joy, peace, serenity, etc. These are interesting times. I had somebody just recently that was bringing up the issue of how dramatically we are being programmed to be at extremes of disagreement and even hatred for people that hold a different view than we do, and how people are being programmed to be afraid. And if that's your experience of listening to the news or your friends or conversations at work, etc., then some of the tools that Michael and Jeannie have to offer and the understanding about how powerfully the misuse of these mind-body energy system, etc., is the creative force that's constructing the upset that we don't want in our lives. And if we're aware of that, then we can make changes. We can do things differently. So, as I was reading the last time from Butterflies Are Free to Fly, he was talking about the double slit experiment, which in the quantum physics, if you don't know about it, it's really worth looking up on YouTube. Just type in double slit experiment quantum physics. And what you'll see is that they've pretty much answered the question of, is light a wave or a particle? And the answer to that is sometimes it acts like a particle, sometimes it acts like a wave. And the big determining factor for how it acts is whether or not there's an outside force of consciousness observing it. So he writes, originally, scientists thought this might be because the electrons were showing themselves to work more like particles than a wave because they were shooting a lot of electrons at the same time. So they ended up deciding to shoot one electron at a time, and it still did the same pattern. So the electrons weren't bouncing off of other electrons, and they still acted in the way that was very confusing. If you think light is a particle or if you think light is a wave, you would expect it to act a certain way. And what they found in that double slit experiment is it changes. And essentially, the observation, the conclusion is a lot of things are not the way we thought they were. When we think of our world as being so solid and set and rigid and knowable, a lot of it doesn't lend itself to being known through our five senses and the science that we've put together so far. So Chapter 5 in this book is titled The Field, and he writes, "Electrons are both waves and particles. One minute they act like a particle, the next they act like a wave. At the time, no one could really believe any of this was actually true. Something must be wrong, they thought. So the scientists modified the experiment, and it still worked the same way." And some of the summaries are, the electron is very peculiar in the sense that when you're not looking, the electron can be here, can be there, can be over there. It can be all over this room, so to speak, but whenever we look, and then it says, hyphen, this is the strange thing about this electron, hyphen, we always find them in one particular Geiger counter. Although we have a room full of Geiger counters, this is fundamentally important stuff about the electrons. There is compelling evidence that the only time quanta, these energy packets, ever manifest as particles is when we're looking at them. When an electron isn't being looked at, it's a wave. When it's being looked at, it's a particle. In the early 1900s, he writes, scientists had started using the term quanta, referring to the energy associated with an electron bound to an atom, which results in the stability of atoms and of matter in general. So the term quantum mechanics, and now more commonly quantum physics, has to do with the study of electrons and their energy. The word quantum is also synonymous with wave or particle, a terminology that is often referred to something that possesses both particle and wave qualities, a quantum. Now, this is truly radical. An electron is a wave until it's observed, and then it becomes a particle. The ramifications here are enormous. It means, really means, that the physical universe, which we have always thought to be solid and predictable, is not real, in quotes, is not solid and predictable, in quotes, at all, because the basic building blocks of that universe are not particles of matter, but waves of possibilities, waves of potential locations where an electron might appear as a particle when it is observed. And then the question is, who is this observer? And how does an observer change the electron from a wave into a particle? The first question is not easy to completely answer at the moment. The observer, in quotes, can be a human being looking at something. It can be a machine or a device that's set up to watch or record or measure something. It can be literally anything that attempts to see something out there in the physical universe. And yet there's another level to the answer which needs more information before we can make sense of it, and so we'll just have to wait. Right now, it's worth repeating the inescapable conclusions of the double-slit experiment. And they are as follows. According to quantum physics, the atoms, nucleus and electrons, that make up the physical universe that we consider to be so real only appear to be solid when they are being observed. When they are not being observed, they return to a wave state of infinite possible locations. So now let's talk about how an observer changes an electron from a wave into a particle. Wait a minute. No one really knows the answer to the question of how or why the observer changes the electron from a wave into a particle. Experts can only speculate. Here's a quote. Particles aren't really what they seem to be. They are momentary manifestations, momentary, quote, poppings, close quotes, of this quantum wave function in which there is no particle. There is just this waviness, which can spontaneously pop out as particles, close quotes. In other words, when an electron is viewed by an observer, these waves of possibilities pop and assume a specific location in space and time, which is what we see as, quote, reality, close quotes. This is called, quote, collapsing wave function, close quotes. Collapsing the wave function can be very successfully explained and predicted mathematically using complex quantum mathematics, but it's very hard to describe in simple English. Basically, it means an electron normally lives in a wave state, a wave function, that includes many possibilities, perhaps infinite possibilities, of where it could end up as a particle. And when the electron is observed, those multiple wave states are, quote, collapsed, close quotes, to one state, the state of being a particle in a specific location. Physicist Nick Herbert says, this sometimes causes him to imagine that behind our back, the world, parentheses, where we are not looking and cannot observe, close parentheses, is always a radically ambiguous and ceaselessly flowing quantum soup, close quotes. But whenever we turn around and try to see the soup, our glance instantly freezes it and turns it back into what we call reality. Herbert believes this makes us all a little like Midas, the legendary king who never knew the feel of silk or the caress of a human hand because everything he touched turned to gold. His quote is, likewise, quote, likewise, humans can never experience the true texture of quantum reality because everything we touch turns to matter, close quotes. So, where are these electrons living as waves of possibilities when no one is observing them and collapsing their wave function into a particle? To answer that, we have to understand that the potential answer to that question has gone through a lot of revision over the years and has been called a lot of things as the research has progressed. It used to be called the Planck scale by the physicist Max Planck. It used to be called the implicate order by physicist David Bohm. It used to be called the vacuum state. It used to be called the quantum wave function. It used to be called the zero point, or it used to be called the superstring field, the M field, and the unified field. Today, it's mainly just called, quote, the field, capitals, capital T and capital F, the field. In her book, The Field, Lynn McTaggart defines it as a field of all possibility. Everything you can think of and everything you can't think of and everything no one can think of already exists in this field as waves of possibility. Dr. John Hagelin explains, quote, progress in our understanding of the universe through physics over the past quarter century has been exploring deeper levels of natural law, from the macroscopic to the microscopic, from the molecular to the atomic, to the nuclear, to the subnuclear levels of nature's functioning. And what we've discovered at the core basis of the universe, the function of the universe is a single universal field of intelligence. So all the forces of nature and all the so-called particles of nature are now understood to be just different ripples on a single ocean of existence. It's called the unified field, or superstring field, that is at the basis of everything, mind and matter. That field is a non-material field. plants, trees, peoples, animals, all of these are just waves of vibration of this underlying unified superstring field. It's the fountainhead of all the laws of nature, all the fundamental forces, all the fundamental particles, all the laws governing life at every level of the universe have their unified source in the unified field. Abstract potential. This rises in waves of vibration to give rise to the particles and to the people and to everything we see in our vast universe. This isn't the world of electrons. It is the world of potential electrons. And that's what we're made of. Dr. Alan Wolf, Fred Alan Wolf, puts it this way. Quote, physicists give this a name. They call it a quantum wave function because it seems wavy. However, this wave function isn't just a wave of matter like an ocean or a sound wave or any kind of wave of matter. It's a wave of possibility. It's a kind of a thought wave. And because it is a wave of thought or possibility, or not matter, it's invisible to us. But we can't explain what we do see as matter unless we picture that these matter particles somehow come out from or emerge from these thought wave patterns. And you can read more about this, you can see more about this if you look up the movie What the Bleep, and the Down the Rabbit Hole version, where Drs. Hegelin and Wolf discuss it in the movie. Fred Alan Wolf said, quote, we can't explain what we do see as matter unless we picture that these matter particles somehow come out of or emerge from these thought wave patterns. So, just paying attention to what they're doing in physics lends credibility to the observation in the Way of Mastery that says we are creating our own experience of life. We don't experience anything that we haven't called into being in a way that we haven't chosen or asked for. And that's from the first lesson and all the way through, woven through the lessons that we've been reading. If we come back to the Way of Mastery, we're at lesson 31, titled, Placing Your Trust and Loyalty in Love. Now, I recommend that we question everything and live in observation rather than trusting blindly. But the title of this chapter is Placing Your Trust in Loyalty and Love. And the text reads, Beloved and holy friends, as always, and though I have repeated this to you often, I say it to you again and yet again, it is with joy that I come to abide with you. For relationship is the holiest of places. Relationship between any two who choose to look upon each other, having looked within and found no lack, meaning I'm not trying to get something from you. I'm just looking at you. I'm seeing you as you are. I'm not demanding anything from you. I'm not requesting anything from you. Those two can then look out upon each other and see only perfect innocence, only perfect peace, only perfect love. Therefore, it is with joy that I join with you, for I look upon you with perfect peace and perfect love and perfect trust. My loyalty to you is unshakable. No event that occurs in the realm of your space and time can taint the loyalty, which I know to the depth of capital T truth, that is your very higher self, capital S self. That which is unshakable, unchanging, unchangeable, and unchanged forever. For my loyalty is perfectly pure. My trust of you is unfathomable and immeasurable. Now you might ask, how can this be so? For perhaps even now your mind says, well, yes, but last week I got a little angry with my spouse, and 3 weeks ago I forgot to pay for that candy bar I picked up at the store, so I'm a very horrible person, and your loyalty is misplaced, Yeshua. The text goes on and says, my trust in you emerges from my trust in all of creation. My trust in you emerges from the perfect knowledge that you belong only to that one that I have called Abba, Father, Abun. My trust, then, is the expression of what I have come to know as I have looked into the depth of my own being, both within my physical incarnation that became rather famous, and also since then, where I have discovered the perfection of capital L love that pervades all things and can be seen beneath the surfaces and can be seen through the appearances that the body's eyes and the ego's thought system would show you. So what do I mean by that? Well, as you abide in your physical world, the greatest challenge you have moment to moment, and then again, moment to moment, is to be vigilant against identifying with the perceptions, all of the perceptions which have been born and birthed as a result of the physical apparatus of the body itself. That is, you look out through a body, that is where your attention seems to be. Your apparatus called your eyes immediately shows you a world of objects separated by space. I mean, we're just reading from the book Butterflies Are Free to Fly that our science now knows this world is not solid in that way, that we are actively, powerfully changing how the world looks to us, how we experience it moment to moment through the process of interacting with it at a fundamental physics level and through the process of interpreting from our past experiences, because we carry around beliefs that we think entitle us to know what is going on, to know who a person is and what they're thinking and what they're going to do in this situation or that situation. The text here goes on and reads, if you identify with that level of perception, you can only conclude that you are separate and you are separate from one another. When you see events happening, it's absolutely impossible to see the subtle interconnection of all events. You fall into the trap of forgetting that you live in the universe, and universe means simply one turning or one song or one event occurring, like an ocean is but one event expressing as many waves. So too do all events in the field of space and time, in the field of physical matter, all of these merely emerge from that one field of thought, that one universe, that one potential of waves. For instance, you love someone. They are here today, and tomorrow they leave. you see them pack their things and their body leaves. And your eyes show you that they are, quote, gone, close quotes. Then the mind says, quote, woe is me. I've lost my love, close quotes. Well, in fact, neither of these is true. The soul, the level at which reality is far deeper than the level of the body, the soul can never go anywhere. No one you've ever met or known can ever be outside of your heart through his or her own action. The body mind, yes, it can leave, but that is not what takes someone out of your heart. It can only be your decision to withdraw your love or your attention from them. It's only the withdrawing of love that creates separation or this temporary experience of separation of your awareness. So now, you are sitting two levels removed from reality. First, you become hoodwinked, thinking that the physical eyes are showing you what's true, and then you draw conclusions and create interpretations of the events of the body's eyes as they show them to you. This creates the emotional effect that is like a soup that runs through you and around you, and it will remain so until it is healed. The third level of being removed from reality is the trick of the mind in which it insists its interpretations are the truth. It is to this level of mind that I asked within the Course in Miracles, quote, would you rather be right or happy, close quotes. For happiness can only be the result of perfect trust, and perfect trust emerges from perfect loyalty, and perfect loyalty emerges spontaneously in the mind that has rested in surrender. We've spoken often of the keys to the kingdom, and they are desire, intention, allowance, and surrender. In allowance, you go through a period of undoing in which you disconnect the wiring that has led you to insist on the rightness of the interpretations that you've created, and then you've linked to the events that the physical body mind has perceived. So, as allowance is perfected, a person has come to see that their whole world, everything they've constructed, has been undone. That is, your perception of belief, your perception of your feeling nature, your perception of that which has been undone, the mind is unraveled. Now, the perception of the body mind, of course, goes on. It keeps working. The physical eyes may seem to show you that there's someone in another body over there and tell you that what they're doing is right or wrong, good or bad, etc., and that you're doing what you're doing over here, so there can't be any connection. That level goes on as long as there is a body. However, the mind that is healing does not identify as the primary, doesn't identify that, the body, the physical realm, as the primary level of reality. So as allowance surrenders the construct that has been made up in the mind, and by the way, that construct exists nowhere but in the mind, as it surrenders that construct, that mind rests unobstructed allowance of how the body mind goes through its days until it turns to dust. There is no longer, quote, being hoodwinked, close quotes. There's no longer being attached, no longer being swept up with that level of identification, because there's no longer a need to identify with the interpretations. And there's no longer, quite happily, any need to be right. This is why in Michael Rice's worksheet and in the forgiveness pattern, it's such a central theme to say, I cancel my need to be right. I cancel my need to make up another story out of the impressions that I brought into this room with me, into this moment with me, to try and prove that my fear and hostility-based story, the reality, the picture I'm creating, is true. I'm going to cancel my need to be right about this. The mind that heals and wakes up and recognizes that what the senses are showing it is not all there is, and it's a very poor approximation of this infinite potential that we call life, this quantum soup that hasn't yet been collapsed. And the more we wake up to that, the more we cancel our need to be right, the more we interrupt the programming of the intellect and open to what the Way of Mastery would call the awakened heart, and we step into using it as our primary interface with life rather than our intellectual knowing, our lives change dramatically. Powerfully and dramatically. The text here goes on and reads, as allowance comes to completion, something quite magical happens. It's beyond all comprehension to the thinking mind, because the ego could never comprehend this. It is as though something that was existing before, because it was contracted in fear, it dies and dissolves like a mist rising before the sun. And all that is left is a quiet spaciousness in which awareness has been purified. All the events arise and pass away. One continues to talk with their friends, perhaps just the same way they always have. One notices the tendency in the body mind to create interpretations, and some of them are quite necessary. Oh, that light has just turned red. My interpretation is it must be a good idea to stop here. And yet, there is now something that is wrapped around all of that. When your mind is healed and awakened, something in your mind has wrapped itself around all of that so that what is arising is seen as ultimately quite inconsequential, quite innocent, and quite devoid of any deep value. The thing that has deep value is the consciousness that's observing all of this. The text goes on and says, for you will place your loyalty on what you have decided to value. And in that spaciousness, in that perfect stillness, in that deep peace, mind or selfhood dissolves in surrender. You can surrender all of your beliefs about yourself. You can surrender all of your beliefs about your brother and sister. You can surrender all of your perceptions, as it calls us to in the third lesson of the Way of Mastery. Events still arise and fall away. A person talks to their friends, perhaps as they always have. It notices the interpretations, and yet it understands there's something far more going on here. For you will place your loyalty on what you have decided to value. And in that spaciousness, in that perfect stillness, in that deep peace or selfhood, what you think of yourself dissolves in surrender. Anyone who has awakened knows exactly what that feels like. Anyone who has begun to awaken has touched on moments of perfect surrender. For in that surrender, the mind beholds that all things that are arising and passing away are perfectly harmless. Because the thing that's watching them arise and pass away is not passing away, was always there and will always be there. And why would that which is unchanged, unchanging, and unchangeable forever identify with something that's here today, gone tomorrow? that's fleeting, that's very temporary. The text goes on and reads, only a fool would create loyalty to that which is temporary, which is temporal. Ultimately, it's unfulfilling. The wise of heart have decided to place their value on that which is eternal, unchanged, unchanging, unchangeable forever. What is that? All of life, the flow of life, flow of creation, God, light, love. Therefore, in the way of the heart and in the way of transformation, and now in the way of knowing, all that we've sought to share with you has been by design to lead you to see that capital L love is the only thing worth valuing. Capital L love is unconditional. It merely extends itself in order to abide in its own nature. And because the Creator is but love, as the mind disentangles from its thoughts about itself, its identification with its limited self, the temporary part of its existence, the perceptual part of the body-mind, it disentangles itself from the interpretations that have been select, chosen, valued, and it disentangles itself from the egoic need to be right about what it has made, these impressions it's made, these actions it's taken, etc. That which you truly are, this pure intelligence, this pure intuitive creative possibility, it shifts itself into being identified only with valuing love, capital L love. That's the same thing as saying, I value only love. I value only God. I value only light. I value only the capital T truth of creation. And then the soul begins to reawaken. The soul, with this drop of pure light, which is pure intelligence, begins to realize that to know its creator, it must be a part of creation. And since creation is only love, the soul desires to be only love. For in loving as the Creator loves, the Creator is known. As the Creator is known, capital S, your true self, is realized and remembered. And the dream of the dreamer is transcended. Therefore, indeed, beloved friends, my trust in you is perfect, for I have come to value only the Creator. My loyalty to you as the offspring of my Father stems from having received that enlightenment for myself, having awakened from the maze, from the complex web of perceptions of the body-mind, awakened from the interpretations of that body-mind and its places on events, and awakened from the ego's construct of what it feels it is right about. Because I have dissolved all of that, I abide in pure devotion only to that, to what is truly real and perfectly unconditional. I abide in pure devotion to the Creator, which is the same as the presence of love. So the next section asks the question quite deeply, where have you placed your loyalty? And we've read this before, so I'm not going to keep reading for today, but I'm just going to remind us that the call in this work is to question, is to observe, is to play playfully with childlike curiosity, question, what am I giving my value to? What do I value above everything else? When I get angry because my washer and dryer have quit working, And the repairman comes out and says, this is so old it can't be fixed. Nobody makes these parts anymore. They haven't made them for decades. And I decide to generate anger. That's all happening inside me. There's nobody across the planet who knows about the anger I'm generating. So from quantum physics to deep spirituality, we are seeing connections, we are seeing the potentials, we are seeing the impact of how we are creating. Out of nothing, we create our emotional states, our physical trauma responses, our anxiety responses. I had somebody I was working with yesterday that was sending me messages about a very difficult day. They were having a very difficult day, and the thing that kept making it even more difficult was their body was going through these responses as though they were in physical danger. The body kept going into near panic. And no actual physical threat occurred to this person throughout the entire day. Looking back on the day, everything unfolded and everything got done. And whatever didn't get done can be done today or tomorrow or the next day. And yet, this person was having internal physiological responses that could be measured by increased heart rate and blood pressure, probably spikes and dips in blood sugar, that were all driven by an internal thought process, by valuing certain thoughts about others, by creating a sense that what was not true is true. One of my favorite lines from the spiritual teachings over the years is that the vast majority of suffering that we do as human beings can be said to be the result of pretending that what is true is not true, and or pretending that what is false is going to lead me to the truth or that might be true someday. So think about that for yourself. How and often are you in a situation where your procrastination about something or you're upset about something, if you step back and observe it, you might step into the realization that, oh, I'm basically trying to pretend that I have the ability to pay off this credit card, and so I'll go ahead and rack up some more debt, and it's not really true. I don't really have that ability because the credit card situation is stacked against us as users. Unless we're paying it off each month. I heard the other day about somebody that's got, I mean, this happens 3 or 4 times a week in my practice, where somebody comes in and they or a family member has debt that's crippling them. And most of those debts that are crippling people are either from they're upside down in a car or a house, or they're carrying around thousands of dollars in credit card debt. Well, the credit card system is set up to keep you in debt and to make them billionaires. When I go out and put another charge on a credit card, knowing I've got a balance that I haven't paid off for a year or two or five, isn't that a way of saying I'm going to pretend that I have more money than I actually have? So I'm pretending that something that's false could actually be true. And the truth of it is I'm living way beyond my means. Guy Finley said he's going to write a book one time and no one's going to want to buy it. And the title of the book is going to be Living Beneath Your Means. So what if we can step into the realization at deeper and deeper levels that every time we get sad, scared, angry, emotional hurt, confusion, overwhelm, that it's inside of us that that's occurring, and it's occurring because of what we are doing with our mind energy. It's happening because of what we're doing with our thoughts. It's happening because of the thoughts we've been pouring a lot of energy into and valuing over other thoughts. And it's not happening anywhere else. There can be people right next to us who are not sharing in our anxiety. There can be people right next to us who refuse to get upset about what they just saw on the news. And we can choose rage. We can choose overwhelm, hurt, confusion, grief. And if you like those feelings, more power to you. Have at it. If you don't like those feelings, the tools that are available on whyagain.org and the mindshiftersacademy.org website for the mental short version of that worksheet are really a good option for a lot of people. I should mention here near the end of our first hour that 2 weeks ago, yesterday, I was the talking head expert, you might say, on a webinar that was a 90-minute webinar. And if you missed it or you want to get a link to it, you want to share it with somebody, you can go to the mindshiftersacademy.org website on the educational materials page. And the very bottom of the page, there's a link to the replay of the webinar featuring me on the Usual Suspects webinar hosted by Dr. Kristen Ryman. So there's a link that will just take you to the Vimeo the Vimeo platform, and there's a I think it's just about a 90-minute video there. Yeah, an hour and a half. So that's available. You can copy and paste that link. You can click on it and watch it yourself. You can send it to somebody. And I've been asked about that a couple times, so I was able to get it uploaded to the MindShiftersAcademy.org website. And we have 5 or 6 minutes for comments or questions. If you want to raise a hand, 563-999-3581. Call that number. Press 1 on your phone. And we can have a conversation. In lieu of that, we are doing an audiophile replay for Michael and Jeannie in this next hour. The second part of something she has titled, An Apparent Physical Fatigue and Burden Resolved by Forgiveness. Area code 541, you're in the air.
Good morning, Dr. Tim. Celinda here. I wanted to make a comment, if I might, on your trust of this statement. I have found when you were reading Butterflies Are Free to Fly about trust, I have found that it's when I distrust that I don't ask questions. So I thought I would just share that with you. I don't see being in the question and trusting different from each other. I understand what you're saying about blind trust, because that's like the other one is the authority. But a flat line, egalitarian trust between two people who are empowering themselves and each other, which is my perception of Awun or Abba. I ask questions. I shut up when I'm just trusting. And that's when I fall down the rabbit hole big time. I just wanted to share that perception with you from my brain and how it works for me.
So when you trust, you are questioning?
I question. I'm free to question.
When you're trusting, you are questioning, right?
Right.
Okay. So if that's what works for you and that's the way you want to talk about it and think about it, go right ahead.
Yeah, and it's not blind trust. I agree with you 100% about blind trust, because that's just the authority you just do what the authority says. You shut your mouth. You don't talk back, etc. So I agree with you there. I don't have. I just was wanting to share with you how I make an understanding of trust and distrust. Not that it's true or anything, but it works for me. Thanks.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm glad that you were sharing that. I will let you have that. My phrasing works differently in my head, but as long as I'm questioning, I'm directly observing, I'm in a much better position. It's the way
exactly.
I drive my car. It's the way I have found most beneficial to live my life, and just do what works for you.
You know, it might just be a matter of languaging, Dr. Kemp. We might be actually on the very same page.
Probably. It so often happens.
And thank
you. All right,
you.
Well, you're very welcome and deserving. I'll mute you so you can listen to the second hour. I will remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff that we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. There will be a support group tonight if you want to join. It's absolutely free. Go to mindshiftersacademy.org website and look up the Tuesday Zoom meeting information. And this is your second hour.
I'm doing really well, thanks. Energy is still here. I did 4 wake-up sheets, which isn't a huge amount, but boy, I don't know how interesting it is to go, but it all, you know, there's one place in one of the, I think it's the Walzak worksheet. He says, is this a familiar feeling? Is this the first time I have felt this feeling? Every feeling is something I have felt before, either in utero or from ages 1 through 8. And that was a wonderful door opener, because I thought, okay, good. I don't have to think about last month or a year ago. I'm going to go to that early time. And then there it all was, the whole deal. I've told you much about this before. I have a younger sister who has been dependent. Tim's been paying her rent for years. Before that, she lived on an IRA that my mother set up, never believing that my sister would live as long as she's living. And the IRA ran out about 10 years ago. My sister has been in poor health. A lot of it is due to poor choices she made. And I have been so angry at her for so long. And not looking at it, so intolerant and judgmental. To this day, I can tell the stories and work up my dander, you know, and feel like strangling her, but she's the one I've been wanting to strangle my whole life. And our person in the house is a lot like her in some ways. So it's much more convenient to put all the stuff on him and not face the real issue. So the wake-up sheets have all been about her. I did one on Michael, our tenant, but it very quickly went to my sister. And the thing that I've been doing over and over and over with my sister and with Michael and probably everybody else is it's verbalized in the Tim Hayes detailed processing of your 5-step wake-up sheet where he says, I keep repeating the idea, I cancel my need to be right and refuse to make up another image or story based on my brain content / reality to prove that I am right. In my case, right about Michael, right about my sister. And I generate these stories and the temptation to generate permutations of this story. If I get rid of one image of helplessness or whatever, or manipulation or lying or whatever I think I see the other person doing, I'll make up another one to keep the denial going and the anger justified. And then because I've had a person living in the house to whom I have to be civil and kind and understanding, that's when it all started. This guy moved in 8 months ago, and that's when I started getting tired. You told me to look at the calendar. I blamed it on COVID, but it's not COVID. It hasn't been COVID. It's been much earlier than that. Sitting on judgment, rage, misplaced. God, I've got work to do, but it's sitting right in front of me. And the thing is, I'm so excited, so glad to have this out and not in my body.
That's powerful.
Yeah.
Well, and you remember that the purpose of words, which come from, according to the Course in Miracles, the world of darkness rules, they're symbols of symbols, can't speak the truth. But the purpose is to simply deny in, quote, words the world of darkness understands, unravel and recognize the unreality, the untruth that we're telling. And the next untruth I'm going to ask you to look at is that you ever were angry at your sister. You've never been angry with your sister. You, me, nobody has ever been angry with anyone. We're just angry.
Yeah. Okay.
And notice your focal point is assisting the young people in your world to end their addiction. And there's an old saw that says we teach best that which we most need to learn. I think it was Richard Bach in his book Illusions.
Mm-hmm.
So it's time to end your addiction to anger.
And it's huge.
It's a big one. I'm going to suggest, once again, I don't know if you ever watched it or if we showed it at the intensive you were at Heartland a few years back, but watch the film, Thank You for Sharing.
I did see it, yep. I should look again, though.
So in the context of this conversation, recognizing that your drug is anger.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we could probably put judgment in the same category.
Okay.
Watch it with that perspective and notice, yes, the power of that film. And I don't know whether they knew what they were doing or it was accidental or it's because it's just so obvious in the addiction world. But in each case where one of the people in the film is getting ready to fall off the wagon, getting ready to go back to their substance of choice,
right,
they demonstrate that before they go to their substance, before they actually fall off the wagon into what the world calls their, you know, their alcoholism or their addiction to pills, their addiction to rage, or their addiction to sex, each one of them goes to anger.
Oh.
That's their first drug of choice. It's an internally produced drug. And then when that's not enough of an anesthetic, when they can't keep the pain anesthetized with that, that's when they turn to a substance. When you start, you know, as your grandson shared with you, I know that I have to follow a routine in order not to turn to my addictive substance again. I know that I can't use ever again. And therefore, I'm going to keep up the routines that I need in order to maintain my sobriety.
Yeah.
My offering is that's your challenge in regard to anger. You've got to stop being a user. To me, that cue that the Course in Miracles gives us is nobody can ever be tired. It's not possible.
Carrying the burden.
Nobody can do. It's going to wipe out and wear out everybody. The purpose of pain, to make our ears grow, to point us in the direction of looking within at what do I need to embrace inside of me, not what do I need to embrace in the world. When I'm able to embrace what the world triggers in me that I've hidden from myself, I'm going to just naturally be the presence of love in the world. That's just what's going to be. No matter what the atrocity is, no matter what the crazy is, I'm just going to naturally be the presence of love for that. And we have to work at embracing it. You know, whether it's the warmonger or the plight of the refugee or the, you know, insane use of plastics.
Yeah.
I'll just be the presence of love for that. And out of that space of love, I'll know exactly the corrective action to take to bring healing to that in the world. But until I've embraced what's in me that I've dissociated from, that becomes my guide. I substitute that via a projected construct called perception that separates me from the actual world that the Creator created for us. People, once they get past the age of 4 or 5, never visit the Creator's world, never visit the world of actuality. They're totally, completely locked into the world of perception. And you remember that lesson from the Course, what is the world? The world is false perception. It will remain no longer than the thought that gave it birth is cherished. When you no longer have use for anger, you'll touch into the thought underneath it. When you heal the thought underneath it, then you'll, having embraced that underlying energy, you'll simply be vitalized physiologically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually by the simple fact that the Creator put the breath of life in you. And that's what life is. It's the movement of love through ourselves. What moves in me that I need to embrace to return to that?
I feel as if what's going to be needed now is acute vigilance, because my habit of making up another story to justify my position is just huge. I'm really good at it.
Becoming the thinker apart from the thought, the feeler apart mm-hmm. from the feelings, the actor apart from the actions. Being able to observe your own perceptual mind and the self mm-hmm. that is a product of your perception, is the power of that is beyond comprehension.
Like to be able to keep the full spectrum in mind in every interaction. Although when you're in the refugee center or something equivalent, you don't really need to do all that. But out in the world, I'm afraid I'll just be making up more stories and justifying my position and going back into my junk and getting pooped. Don't want to go there again.
What I allow to rip me off for the presence of love in me is what I have not yet forgiven from my heart.
Yep.
So ultimately that guide that says you must forgive from your heart the wrongs of your brother, it's not
yeah.
a leading heart statement. It's I have to go into my unconscious and remove what I've projected into my brain's image of anyone or anything. And that yep. takes being eternally vigilant, because it can sneak
That's...
up so easily, so subtly.
Absolutely.
And be so justifiable.
Mm-hmm.
After all, isn't everybody upset about this?
Yeah.
Because nobody's ever been upset about anything. There's just upset in them. And when they give it up, then they're the presence of love that brings healing to the circumstance.
Yes. Well, I thank you very much. I don't have much to say. It's just the ball's rolling and it's ongoing. And I just thanks for, I feel as if I've been released from something I couldn't find my way out of.
And you might want to take ownership of that. You have released something.
Mm.
Now, you know, I've been released is disowning again.
Okay.
And so the propensity to disown any state of mind is probably another 77 times 70 worksheets that you'll do.
All right. I see.
Including the healed, magnificent state of mind that is the mind of Christ that is yours in you.
Mm.
To be willing to own that is monumental as well. Because we've been purposely beat down by power persons, by governments, by kings. It's an old king's thing to beat people down so that they always, no matter what, there's always a chain to yank to pull them back into slavery.
Yeah.
Well, there's a challenge in owning our hate, our fear, our rage, our guilt, our grief. Probably the bigger challenge is owning your magnificence and the truth about you as a created human essence called love. That might be the most challenging one for most people.
You know, insights sound awful, but it's such a relief to get them rather than suppress them.
Yes.
So,
I think a really important key, especially when people are unwilling to look at things, is to recognize that anything you embrace in your true nature will always be a benefit, will always be a gift, no matter how horrific the experience might have been. Once it's transformed by the presence of love, you know, actual present love, and that's, of course, one of the skills that needs to be developed to do the work, then everything is a gift. The whole, you know, every aspect of life becomes a gift at that point. And if there's something that doesn't look like it's a gift yet, it's because it hasn't been embraced in love. Now, there's an interesting story about a man in the dream in the scriptures, you'll recall, and he's wrestling with an angel, a gift.
Right.
And he's not going to let go till he gets the gift. He stays with it, stays with it, stays with it, stays with it. And that's what needs to happen with these issues that, you know, I mean, I can have an inkling of something that I need to deal with. And if I'm eating the sad diet, you know, I smoke pot or, you know, drink alcohol or do my, you know, drugs that shut down vitality, then I might hang out with that issue for decades. And then when I finally decide to shift and go to the next level of vitality, the vitality required to open that aspect of that gift is, that's when I can open it and receive it. But otherwise, if one stays in resistance, no, I don't want to. So everything's a gift, ultimately. But if we count on perception, oh, man, we can give anything. We can give anything all kinds of horrific attributes.
Yeah.
Because of the horrific things in ourselves we haven't worked through, haven't owned yet.
That is so true. And I don't quite know how to accept what has hit me about all this work is that I aligned myself with my mother against my sister. I became my mother, my power person.
Power person.
Type.
Yep.
Mother against my sister. And I have talked to her about the realization of this right now, but I said to my sister, you know, you tell me that you had a terrible time at school and you were bullied a lot for being a crybaby, which, of course, made you cry more, or, you know, that's using the old language, but she chose
right.
to cry more. And I said, but, Joe, I wasn't nice to you when we were little. I was very critical of you. I was jealous of you. I wanted to strangle you. Talk about the same words I used the other day.
Yes.
Don't you remember? And she said, you know, We had such good times, too, which we did. I used to make up stories and tell her stories, and whenever my parents weren't around, we were friends. But when my parents came, my mother came around, we were enemies, and it was instantaneous. But I said,
so notice, that's a powerful clue. That's a powerful clue. Remember the three levels of behavior related to the power person dynamic. When there's little or no stress, I'll do whatever I did to get along with my power person.
Mm-hmm.
When stress
yeah.
starts to build, I'll do what I did to resist and survive. And when I become ultra-stressed, I'll do what my power person did to me that I hated the most.
Uh-huh.
So you just acknowledged that what your power person did to you and the fact that you passed it on to your sister.
Yeah,
and
good.
What that would imply is that when your parents were around, probably especially mom, then there were all kinds of goals active in your mind, probably in order to stay safe or be accepted or be what people call loved. And so when mom and or dad showed up, those goals were activated, and that's what kicked in the power person dynamic toward your sister.
Mm-hmm.
So yep. It would be wise to do worksheets looking at what all those goals might have been with your power person and doing worksheets to get rid of those goals. Because remember that once a goal is set in the mind, there are only two ways to move it into an inactive state. One is to achieve it. Two is to
mm-hmm.
cancel it. And if
mm-hmm.
it's never been canceled, and notice, you know, the goals were there even when mom wasn't there, but they weren't active
mm-hmm.
and therefore didn't impact your relationship with your sister. But
mm-hmm.
as soon as that power person showed up and all those goals went into resonance, that's when you're stressed. You would overwhelm with stress and move to that behavior. And the very behaviors that you just described are probably the very behaviors you remember detesting from your power person.
Well, I didn't hit my sister. Well, sometimes I did, but I didn't have a riding crop and thrash her. But I
right.
disapproved of her. I criticized her outwardly and in my mind. And later in life, she did a couple of things which were really not sisterly, and that's putting it mildly. The first one was when I brought Tim Bingham home to introduce him to the family, my sister got all just flirted like mad with him. She thought she could get him. She could win him for herself, which was very competitive. And then the other thing, which I tell you, Michael, I've been told this by my son, and I have forgotten it, literally forgotten it more than the one or two times. And my daughter, I was telling my daughter about doing this wake-up sheet business and how my fatigue seems to be gone, knock on wood, you know, the all other shoe isn't dropping, and I'm very happy about it. But she said, Mom, don't you remember that Joe also molested Jonathan when he was a little boy? She used to babysit. And finally, Jonathan would disappear whenever Joe came over, my sister came over. Jonathan would make sure he was not home. And it was only this year that he told me that she did that. And he had a word for it in his mind. He has a name for her in his mind, which I won't repeat, but he's good to her. He's cordial and kind, and we invite her to dinner when there's a family holiday thing. But he said he can't ever, ever be near her without his skin crawling.
Yeah, yeah.
And I keep forgetting that. And my daughter reminded me, and I thought, this too might be sitting down there. And one of the reasons I've been so tired is I've been sitting on whatever it is, anger at her, horror at her. I don't even know how to put it into words, the sense that she,
I understand.
Although she, yeah,
Beyond words.
She's appreciative of Tim and me because we pay her rent. And she'll say so, which is something Michael doesn't even do. But when I see her, I am so repulsed. And the repulse is part of that vulnerability thing we were talking about. It's like she,
right.
You know, what, by learning that about her, she has been exposed to me as a person who would do that. I don't know. Yeah, no words. I don't know what to do with it, but it's out there. I feel as if some poison has been removed from my body, and it's sitting on a table right in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not in my body anymore.
That's awesome. And you do know exactly what to do with it. That's
yeah.
An old voice in your head that you don't know what to do with it. You've got the tools. You know how to use them.
I've got the tools, but I'm not sure I can. I'm not sure I'm willing to forgive this. That's what I mean. I don't know if I'm.
So you'd like to carry that toxic poison around in your body, or keep it on the table longer?
No. I realize that's true, because I still have the idea that I'm doing this for her. If I can think I'm doing it for me, I can do it.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Well, remember that, you know, forgiveness has nothing to do with another person. Forgiveness does not mean
right.
I need to reconcile or I need to ever see them again. It doesn't mean any of that. It means that
yeah.
I remove the toxic load that burdens my structure.
Yeah. Good to remember.
And then, as you do that, you may find the space to pardon her. You may find the space for some compassion and understanding. And I could certainly, I mean, I can't fathom where my head would be. I'd certainly have some work to do if I found out that someone sexually abused my child. That would be a big one.
Yeah.
And at the same time, my mind can go to the place of, I wonder whose gene she's got there. I wonder who sexually abused her and what kind
yeah.
of trauma was inflicted on her that she was lashing out against. Like, was it maybe her way of getting back at you for the behaviors you did to her?
Oh, I think so. And it's way, and I'm not allowed, Jonathan, who told me this, said, do not tell Joe. And do not
right.
tell my husband, and I have not.
No.
He doesn't want even him to know. So here
yeah.
I am blowing it out on the radio show. But
work to be done.
Yeah, but
so,
it has occurred to me that she has been trying to get back at me, and I do understand that. She sure picked
yeah.
the most precious things in my life to undermine.
Do you suppose that with the behavior you just acknowledged that you did toward her, that you undermined some of the most precious things in her life, like her soul?
Yeah, definitely. And she doesn't even acknowledge it. She says, oh, so you didn't do
yeah.
anything. I mean, that was nothing to, compared
yeah.
to being at school.
Yeah. Yeah. Big stuff to open. Your son is 40?
50, almost 50.
50?
I think he's turning 50 in December. Yeah, 1972.
Mm.
Yeah, he's December 28th, 1972.
Just
so
a
he's
kid.
He's 50. Just a kid, I know. He's doing a lot of work, too. We have good talks. I pull out the tools undercover, you know. He does understand
well,
that is it.
Go ahead.
He understands that maybe he's just beginning to consider that maybe daily anxiety is something he doesn't have to live with for the rest of his life. He said that today. We
yep.
talked.
Wow,
says,
that's awesome.
Maybe I don't have to think that it is locked in because I inherited it from my dad. And I've told him about DNA and how you can clear that, and he likes the scientific language. And I also have said, I don't have that anxiety anymore. And I had it in spades ever since I was a teenager, waking up in a near panic every day, unable to eat, going to school with great anxiety, free-floating, not necessarily nervous about any particular thing. I didn't talk to anybody about it because back then you just thought that's the way it is. That's life.
Yeah. Have you done any worksheets on that specifically?
On which?
What you just spoke about, how you, from the time being in danger, you get up with this angst.
Well, that I've gotten rid of it. Is that what you mean? Because
I started
doing wake-up sheets.
Yes. So
and I
my,
told
my suggestion
Jonathan
is,
I don't have that anymore. So I said, he said, how did you get rid of it? And I said, well, I've been using Michael Rice's tools. And I think they are the ticket. They've been the ticket for me to be well. I just don't get that feeling anymore.
Yeah.
And he said, wow.
So my suggestion would be, to take it to the next level and do some worksheets on the teenager who would get up with that kind of anxiety going. And you'll probably uncover a whole different level. And my intuitive hit, and the reason I pursued this, is that this is part of why you don't sleep.
Whoa.
And when you clean that up, you'll probably sleep like a baby.
Well, I'll definitely do it because I would like to sleep like a baby.
Yeah, that would be really, really awesome.
You mean you're thinking
for
that
sure.
I just shoved it into the unconscious and it's sitting in there bothering me at night?
Yes, well, who would want to go to sleep if I know that when I wake up in the morning I'm going to have all this crap in my face? And it's going to be another horrific day. Why would I go to sleep when that's what I'm going to look at? I would say that's a pretty significant piece of your puzzle.
Mm.
Even though it goes back a half a century. Or more.
Yeah.
So when you were a teenager. The other thought that comes when you're talking about Jonathan, he has shared with you directly that your sister sexually abused him?
Yeah.
So then I would open the conversation with him about another level of insight that you've had around that issue and how it's impacted you, and that, you know, if he doesn't deal with that unconscious dynamic, and that's probably a major piece of the root. I mean, the pain, the rage, the violation, the fear, the hatred, the trepidation, I mean, the list goes on with people, you know, that I've heard from who've been sexually abused. The terror. And if he just folded that away as a kid, like, what do I do with this? I can't even tell anybody. You say he just told you in the last year?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what do you suppose he's been carrying around with him? And how do you suppose that's going to reflect in his perceptual mind? So I'd open the conversation with him and offer to sit down and do a worksheet with him.
Can you? My mind is going on tilt. Could you? How would we frame that out? How would I frame it out with him? I'm going to write this down because I can't imagine approaching him with that like that. But why not?
Well, I could easily see. Gee, remember, Jonathan, when you shared with me that you were sexually abused by my sister? Well, that came up for me. I've had all this stuff going on, this anxiety. I haven't been sleeping, and I had this drop in energy. And when I started to look, when I was guided to look, that's what I found in me. And since I've been looking at it and processing through it with worksheets, you know, I mean, the fact that I could hardly move for a good part of every day in the last, I don't know how long, that's been lifted. It's gone physiologically.
Mm-hmm.
And so that he's opened the door with you of, gee, I can now imagine that maybe I could live my life without anxiety. Jonathan, do you suppose that, you know, and do you know what age it was that happened?
His age 4 to 6, about. It was ongoing.
So what do you suppose a child of 4 to 6 does with that kind of assault? And then the other side of it, and I've worked with, and this may be something else that opens up, I've worked with a number of people who have been sexually abused, and there was an aspect of them that enjoyed it. And then there's the guilt of, how terrible am I? So what do you suppose somebody who carries that kind of a thorn in their mind for 45 years, what do you suppose it does to them? And he could be totally free of that, totally and completely. And you could move to the next level, I would offer. This would probably be an important part of your process, where you could actually, rather than be in the unresolved trauma, whatever that looks like, being around your sister, that you could forgive, you could remove that so that you can simply remain as the presence of love in your physiology in your sister's presence.
And I haven't done that yet, for sure.
Who do you suppose suffers from that?
Oh, yeah. We hardly ever see each other. I call her once a week and check in, but it's very superficial.
So it's time to go beyond the superficial.
Okay, you asked the question.
So my question was, what do you suppose it would be like to resolve these dynamics around your sister and stand fully present as the human being that you are, as the presence of love in the presence of your sister? And in doing that, there's going to be a whole other round of energetic dynamics, because there's a good chance that this sexual abuse issue didn't start with your sister and your son. There's a good chance that your sister very likely was sexually abused, and or there's genetic abuse that hasn't been looked at in the family system. And if that's true, and I don't know if you've ever inquired with your grandsons about what is going on in their sexuality, but I'll bet it's there.
How would it be there? What's there? You mean the
sexual abuse
experience? You mean just passed down generationally?
Generationally.
Okay.
And or been played out with those boys.
You mean their parents might have done it to them, or I'm sorry, I'm being so literal.
Their parents, or the kid down the block, or the next door neighbor, or the guy at the grocery store. I don't know.
Oh yeah. Okay.
If that energy of being abused is inside of one unresolved, and there's somebody in the neighborhood that has the potential to be a sexual abuser, they're going to be drawn to each other like magnets. And the issue is going to surface in some way, shape, or form. If one has forgiveness, it will surface for benefit. If one doesn't understand or have the tool of forgiveness, it'll probably be more harm, more trauma.
Mm-hmm. Could it result in confusion?
Absolutely.
One of the grandparents is very confused about which direction he's going, gay or straight.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Confusion, remember, is a mixing of unlike energies. Remember the example I've used of we've got a whiteboard and I shine a red light and a blue light and a green light on the board and we see red, blue, and green, unless we're colorblind and our brain interprets those frequencies differently. Scientifically, there is no such thing as red. There is no such thing as green. There is no such thing as blue. They're just different frequencies that the brain interprets in a certain way. So I have clarity on red, blue, and green when I look at the board. Even if they're all shining at once, I have clarity on them. But what happens if I pull those three beams in and put them on one spot on the board? Because those energies, on a physics level, because those energies are additive and subtractive with each other, the peaks and the troughs, literally, and the frequencies that are there interact and muddy the spot on the board. I don't have a red or a green or a blue spot on the board. I've got some kind of a mixed, I don't know, it's kind of like magenta or, you know, whatever it might end up being. And that would be confusion. That's the mental equivalent of confusion. When you bring frequencies together that are not matching, then they'll interfere with each other, and that interference would look like the muddy spot on the board where the lights are shining, or it looks like the confusion in the mind. And when there's confusion, especially if there's emotional trauma attached to the confusion, my take would be that's going to be one of the first things that knocks out the spiritual faculties and knocks out the soul and knocks out choice. And then one becomes vulnerable to all kinds of crazy things in the culture. So my offering would be to really embrace the benefit of, again, we're back to that principle I spoke of earlier, everything becomes a gift when it's embraced in being. When it's embraced out of the truth of who I am, the most horrific family secret will become my blessing. You know, that's the moment at which I can finally let go of the angel because I've gotten its gift. So there can only be benefit, especially if your son is willing to have that conversation and willing to do some work around it. I could easily see him waking up in the morning and being as free as a bird, especially after 50, 45 years of carrying a load like that.
Yeah, well.
And that will change your sister's life as well. Even if not a word is said, if he resolves that energy, if you resolve that energy, your sister's life's going to change. For the better.
I'm going to stick with that thought, even though I have another thought about another source of Jonathan's anxiety. But this is one of them, I guess I would say.
Yeah,
and I think
good chance it's not singular.
Oh, yeah, okay.
When you look at, you know, if you just look back, go to your childhood and look at all of the adults in your experience, your field of experience as a kid. Mom, dad, mom and dad's grandma and grandpa, each side, uncles, aunts on each side, cousins. Just kind of survey that whole group. And how much trauma do you suppose collectively they were carrying?
Yeah.
And whatever that quantity is, how much insight and knowledge do you suppose any one of them had in how to resolve it? If they had no tools and no insight on how to resolve it, it just became trauma within the household that got passed on to the children. Like as sure as night follows day.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm talking right down to the point where the conception of a child. If, you know, either a man or a woman have been sexually abused, or later happily married, but have never resolved that sexual abuse, and here they are in an intimate position conceiving a child, guess what part of the starting point of that conception is for that child's form? It's that unresolved trauma resonance. And who had the tools to look at it or deal with any of it? You know, perhaps separate out this conversation and share it with Jonathan. I mean, you know, and I'd be delighted to support the conversation if you need some assistance with it. Because it can only benefit him, his son. You know, I don't know if he's married, his wife or former wife, whoever the mother of the child is. Who in the family system knows how to resolve any of this? Is there anybody when you were a kid that you could imagine could even have talked about it or thought about it in any healing way? That kind of an issue?
No. No, not at all. Right. There were no work. There was no scope for talking about anything like that.
Right. There was only the cultural message that for most people goes something like this. Sex is dirty. Save it for the one you love.
Right.
That's the culture.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's I wrote a poem once called Sex is Obscene. And you look at, in this culture, people will sit their child down in front of the most vile, violent movie, murder, slaughter, torture, sexual abuse, will allow them to do that. But to think about looking at a naked body? Oh, my God. So the very thing that virtually, it would be unusual for a grandparent not to want grandchildren. And yet, most grandparents can't fathom that their children actually have sex. That's the insanity of sex in this culture.
Yeah.
And there's only one way to resolve it, and that's through forgiveness. Otherwise, it just, you know, I mean, look at the aberrant sexuality that's going on all around the world, all around the culture. And it's crazy. You know, I mean, there are places where people engage in certain sexual practices and they're going to be killed for it. And in this country, they're being censured for it and destroyed for it. When what needs to happen is all of the trauma and insanity. I remember having a conversation with someone around sexuality issues, and they became so distraught, they actually hung up the phone in the middle of the conversation. I'm saying, wait, we're just opening a space. There's something here to do. Hung up the phone in the middle of the conversation more than once.
Wow.
Why does that happen? Because there's so much unresolved energy around those dynamics. And
Generally,
or somebody has to open the conversation. Somebody has to look at the truth behind it all and start to clean it up. Because here we have people who will easily expose their children to the worst violences of the world, but would never imply to their children that they ever had sex, or would never, you know, to just think about their child actually engaging in sex is just like beyond so many people. And yet it's wholesome, powerful, sweet, beautiful, wonderful thing in the world.
I had a friend who had two daughters, and at one point she learned how you make a baby, and she comes home from school and says, "Dad," and mind you, this guy had two daughters. She said, "You did that twice?"
It's
a very funny story.
Yeah. It's funny. It would be really humorous if it weren't so sad.
Yeah.
That the child isn't brought up with just the knowledge that, gee, we have bodies for a reason, and there's a way they function, and there's a way children are brought into the world. And excuse me, Grandma and Grandpa, if you want a grandbaby, your children are going to have to become intimately involved. And if you haven't given them a totally, completely loving perspective on that intimacy, then there's going to be trauma introduced into that child's life just through the simple act of intercourse.
Mm-hmm.
And sooner or later, somebody has to resolve the crap.
Yeah.
So it sounds like a perfect opening, and Jonathan certainly sounds like he's ready to be finished with waking up in the morning with anxiety.
Yeah, he is. He's very
what an example
curious.
You are.
Well, he's very curious about the fact that I don't have it anymore. And how mm-hmm. did I do that? Well, I didn't do it, but I used some tools that really showed me what I was doing, and somehow I got healed in the process. And so
not somehow. It's as sure as night follows day. When you look at the goal that's involved in any trauma and you cancel it, the perceptual construct that is sourced in unresolved trauma is going to collapse into the root of that trauma. If love is present, mm-hmm. that trauma is going to be resolved. That's all. It's so simple.
Yeah.
I love how the Course talks about it. The Course says, it's so simple, it cannot but fail to be completely understood. Denied, yes, but not ambiguous. And if you refuse it now, it will be because, in your mind, the cost was too high to cancel a goal.
Yeah.
No, I'm going to hold on to this, to my grave. You'll have to pry it from my cold, dead fingers. Cancel that thought. But that's how people hold on to their trauma.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jonathan often says, and Tim Bingham does too, he says, I'm anxious, but I couldn't tell you what I'm anxious about. I'm just as free-floating.
Right.
It's just in there. So, you know, to establish what the goal is or goals are that are inspiring this state, it's going to be,
as
that's
ABC.
I hope so.
Simple as ABC. So you tell me that you went to the grocery store and you started to walk into the grocery store and you just went into this terrible anxiety and you turned around and you got back in the car. Well, how are we going to find out what the goal was? Well, if you were walking to the grocery store and this terrible anxiety was aroused, if you were to look at or ask yourself, what would the ideal outcome here be? There's the goal. Oh, I would have loved to have just been able to, when that anxiety came up, take a gentle breath and go into the grocery store and do my grocery shopping. Then cancel that goal. Remember that, you know, the Course talks about you've got to return your mind to the point where the trauma happened. But that's not a function of memory. You don't have to figure it out. You don't have to go through the memory bank and find the terrible, dirty, awful, horrific thing that happened to you. It's a function of forgiveness. When you engage in forgiveness, automatically, I mean, think about it as a building. So there are all these building blocks called love and wonderment and drama and trauma within the structure. A building comes up out of the structure. The building at this moment is this anxiety while walking into the grocery store. It's based on the content in the mind. All I need to do is look at the ideal outcome in that situation. I've got my goal, and when I cancel it, that structure, that perceptual construct, will collapse in on itself, and bingo, there it is. Bingo. It's that simple. It's just as simple as ABC. Now, the first time I do it, the first worksheet I do on that, I might only get one little nugget of what that's about. It might take doing 77 mm-hmm. times 70 worksheets before I go into the full-blown memory that is accessed by forgiveness, before I've got the vitality to process through it. But it's as simple as ABC. Here I am in a circumstance. What is it? Oh, I was going up to meet the president. And all of a sudden, I had this cold sweat. Oh, what would be the ideal result for that? Oh, it would have been so good if the president just looked at me and saw how I was starting to sweat and warmly came over and embraced me. There's the goal I want to cancel. And it's a function of forgiveness to return the mind to the moment where the original trauma happened. I don't have to figure it out. I don't have to remember it. It's pure, simple function of forgiveness. And I may go into, and it always amazes me in all the years I've been doing this with people, when they cancel the goal, where their mind goes, what they goes, what they drop into. It always still amazes me. And the mind may drop into something that is not cognitive and not something I'm consciously aware of, but I energetically, standing as a space of active present love, start to process the underlying trauma till I'm finished with it. What would the worksheet look like with Jonathan? Well, Jonathan, if you go back and remember that, I mean, you talk about how this still impacts your life. You can't be around her without this coming up. If you go back and just think about what it was like as a child to be touched inappropriately, if you could have, you know, in your adult mind today, if you could have directed that child to say or do something, what would it have been? There's the goal to cancel. Say it again.
You mean establish an understandable goal for him
today,
as if he were capable of it back then? What would he have said or done?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So when you were six and she did la la la, whatever, if you'd have been able to say something or do something, if there was an outcome that would have been helpful to you, what would it have been? And it might be, geez, I wish Mom had walked in the room. It might be, I wish I could have screamed. It might be, I wish I could have, instead of freezing, because chances are one of the things that happens with people when they go into that, they go into sympathetic dominance, and they go into freeze mode, and literally the brain shuts down. It literally is just frozen, can't do anything. You know, a lot of times when there's sexual abuse, especially in rape cases, we heard about some of this in this recent trial that happened that was so, you know, widely publicized. Oftentimes, you know, the rape culture will say, well, she didn't scream, therefore it must have been okay with her. No, buddy, what happened is she went into sympathetic dominance, and one of the symptoms of sympathetic dominance is blood flow to the brain is cut off, and one goes into total, complete freeze mode, can't move, can't say a word, can't do anything. And sadly, that's oftentimes used as a defense. Well, see, that was consent. But it's actually sympathetic dominance in a freeze mode. So it might have been, you know, the goal might have been that I could have just called out, or I could have said no, or, you know, there could be a thousand variations on the theme. The energy patterns are in him to come up with whatever that ideal outcome would have been.
A good question.
You know, it might have been, geez, I wish I could have just gone and told Mom, told Dad.
Yeah.
Or it might have been, I wish I could have resolved my guilt or my fear or my terror. And that would be the starting point for him at 50 to start to dismantle the trauma from that event.
I wonder what it is about kids that they don't tell.
Well, oftentimes they're threatened. Oftentimes, and I'm talking from having worked with people who've been sexually abused, is they enjoyed it and would like more and are going to keep quiet. That's oftentimes a dynamic. Somebody told them how bad they were and how dirty they were and, you know, what were all the superlatives that went along with it. And it's all, I mean, that's sown throughout the field of humanity. Men and women has been sown for centuries. And sooner or later, somebody's got to have the courage to open the genes, pun intended, and move that trauma out of, literally, out of the genetic family heritage.
His way of dealing with it was when he learned she'd come over, he would just get out of the house.
Disappear, yeah. And that would be, my offering would be, that would be an expression of sympathetic dominance. There's the fear. And, you know, in sympathetic dominance, most people become tongue-tied, literally, because the brain, you know, in order to go to survive, blood is shunted away from the brain. And so the brain can't even function, can't even, you know, can't even speak. It sounds like the opening is there with his recent speaking of that and his willingness to step out of anxiety, and you're having stepped out of your anxiety, which had been with you for years, and thrown away the medication, and it's doable for everybody. I mean, there's no reason for it to be there other than there's an energy that hasn't been embraced, hasn't been dealt with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, I forget what the number of people are, but they're monstrous numbers of people who are just taking drugs every day to try and shut that off and not have to deal with it. You know, it's a mechanical form of denial.
Mm-hmm. That it is.
To take the chemical that just shuts down that function. And, of course, when it shuts down that function, it shuts down a whole lot of other functions, and they call those side effects rather than diseases. The truth is every drug is a disease disguised as a cure, period. You know, where's the healing in that? We need to be putting healing alongside treatment. So who knows? This conversation opens with Jonathan. He not only heals, but he transforms his profession.
Yeah.
And it's time. So if you need any support, if it becomes appropriate to have that conversation, if you need any support, I'm here to support you.
Thank you so much.